It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In the days and weeks leading up to the 2016 election, many polls showed Hillary Clinton clinching an easy victory. As we all know, that didn't happen. Now, as we approach the midterm elections, another round of polls are coming out. But should we trust them? My guest says yes, if you read them carefully. Michael Traugott is a research professor at the Center for Political Studies at the University of Michigan. He recently co-wrote a piece for The Conversation called You Can Trust the Polls in 2018 If You Read Them Carefully. Michael, welcome to The Morning Show.
Good to be with you, John.
So let's take the Wayback Machine to 2016. As we mentioned, the polls leading up to the election seemed to virtually guarantee a Clinton victory. And as we all know, that wasn't the outcome that we got. Explain what happened.
Well, first of all, we had an unusual election in which one candidate won a plurality of the popular vote, but the other candidate won more states and secured a majority in the Electoral College. And that mirrored the relative accuracy of the polls. The national polls were pretty accurate about the popular vote. They estimated Clinton would win by a little more than 3 percentage points. She won by about 2. But there was a bias at the state level. And the expectations that a lot of people had of an easy Clinton victory came from operations or people that we call data aggregators who take state-level polls, model them into electoral college vote totals, and because of the bias in the polls, they suggested Clinton would win a lot of states, which she didn't. And Donald Trump won a majority of the Electoral College.
What do you mean by bias?
Well, I'm talking about statistical bias. When we did various kinds of post-election analyses, there were polls, especially in the battleground states, that suggested that Donald Trump would do 5 to 7 percentage points worse than he actually did. And, you know, vice versa for Hillary Clinton. And as you know, in 3 critical states in the upper Midwest, Donald Trump won by about 80,000 votes total. In Ann Arbor, we say that's less than the total attendance at a Michigan football game in the Big House. And so it was a statistical bias that seemed to be fairly systematic.
In Madison, we would say that's less than the total attendance at Camp Randall. That brings us to 2018 and the midterm elections. Naturally, we've got poll results coming out every day. We just heard in our newscast at the beginning of just before this, we started this section of the program, we've got polls coming out for governor in the state of Wisconsin, for example. So for those who are skeptical, saying, well, you know, polls, who cares? These are all wrong anyway. For those who are skeptical about poll results, what would you say to them?
Well, I think that there are a couple of general cautionary notes, and then, of course, the devil is in the details of a specific poll. The general cautionary notes are that the polls are more accurate the closer to the election. So you want to look at the most recent polls and also the trend in the polls. But you also want to pay attention, for example, to the mode of interviewing. For example, there's a lot of polling that's being done at the local level using interactive voice recording techniques, IVR techniques, robo-polls, where the law says that they can only call landline phones. So the omission of cell phones is a major problem often. The other issue is that we have very low turnout in the United States, especially in off-year elections. And so pollsters have to usually adjust the estimate they get from everybody they talk to one of the likely electorate or likely voter sample. They reduce their sample of all respondents to likely voters. And that involves a set of assumptions. And one of the problems in 2016 was that the assumptions were based on the notion that the electorate would look like 2012, but we know now, of course, that it didn't. The electorate in places like Wisconsin was more rural than it had been in the past and was also more white. The turnout in the urban areas was lower than in past elections. And we're going to have lower turnout in 2018 than we did in 2016. So the likely voter modeling is going to be very important as well. And it would be important for pollsters to disclose the assumptions that they're making in the reduction of their sample.
Let's take a call. Patty is with us from Rice Lake. Patty, thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Yes, good morning. Polls have bothered me for a long time. I'd like to hear what the professor says. Why should any individual voter pay attention to the polls instead of the candidate and their issues? And I find polls to be a very big distraction for the news. I hear more about the polls than I do the candidate and the candidate's positions. And I just think they're a big distraction.
Okay, Patty, we get it. Michael, what about it? I mean, poll information good for political campaigns? How useful is it to voters, and is it a distraction?
Well, I think that Patty makes a very important point that for any individual voter, they should be making their decision on an informed basis about how they assess the candidates and their issues. But polls serve an important function to the general public in that they let citizens know what other citizens are thinking about and how they're assessing the candidates. They can provide information about how the issues in the campaign are being reflected in the public's views. One problem with contemporary reporting on polls is that they focus too much on what we call the trial heat question, who's ahead and who's behind, and they don't discuss, or the journalists don't discuss broadly enough, why it is that the voters are making these choices.
Yeah, a lot of concentration on the horse race aspects and scoreboard watching. One of the phrases that comes up a lot in when we talk about polling is margin of error. What exactly does that mean in the context of polling?
Well, the margin of error is a concept that comes out of sampling theory, and it describes a confidence interval around any particular estimate, or the difference between two estimates. For example, when we take a poll about how the Democrat and the Republican candidates stand. But it's based upon an assumption of a particular kind of samplings, probability sampling, simple random sampling. And one issue, of course, is that almost no survey, telephone survey nowadays, is using a simple random sample.
Okay.
So it's a useful guide, but it's not a very precise indicator of the amount of error.
Michael Traugott, thank you so much for spending this time with us. Appreciate your time.
Good to be with you, John.
Michael Traugott is a research professor at the Center for Political Studies at the University of Michigan. Coming up next, we discuss whether diverse representations in children's literature and media impact their perceptions of gender and race. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Accessibility is something that people with disabilities have to consider when planning their travels. But that information isn't always available. But There's good news. There's an app in development that might help fix that. Do you have a disability that makes traveling difficult? What's the hardest part about it? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gabriel Sleevey lives in Eau Claire and is developing an app called The Rebel Traveler's Guide to the World, which focuses on making traveling more accessible for people with disabilities. He's also developing a mobile site. Gabriel, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show today.
Good morning.
So you are currently working on an app and a mobile website called The Rebel Traveler's Guide to the World. Who is this for?
It is for everyone. It does have a focus on people with disabilities, but anyone can use it. Even if you have a bad knees, bad back, if you at all have any difficulty traveling, this app will be for you.
So what was the inspiration for the app and the mobile site? Talk about your personal experience.
The inspiration for the app / mobile website was when I was younger. I was told I couldn't go to China by a family friend, and she said it wouldn't be accessible. And I and my family took that as a challenge. So we went to China, and we lived there for a long while, and I actually climbed up the Great Wall of China. But when I did so, once I got to the top, I actually found out that there was a gondola coming from another province that was nowhere in the tour book for the Great Wall. So I spent all this time and energy getting up to the Great Wall, only to find there was an easier and more accessible way up to the Great Wall. So this came out of my traveling experience, that I personally would like to know all these little tips and tricks to travel. And I thought others would too.
Share with us what the situation is with you physically. What your disability is?
I have cerebral palsy.
And you're in a wheelchair.
I use a wheelchair for long distances. Yes.
Okay. And you do a lot of traveling, so this has been a real big deal for you.
Mm-hmm. This has been a 14-year project.
So, at what point did you kind of have an aha moment here and say, you know what, I should really make an app for this?
That would be about 3 years ago. We found that a lot of people use smartphones now. It's accessible to almost everyone, and it's with the Apple App Store and everything, you can even do free apps, so the information can be with you anywhere, right at your fingertips.
And so how did you collect all of this information? What did you have to do? Because it sounds like an enormous task. You see, you've been working on it for 3 years. I can well imagine. Tell us about the process.
Well, we've been working with several different groups, UCP, a few others, and we've been collecting the data for a long while. Right now, we are focusing on Eau Claire and the Twin Cities for collecting data. We hope to move to expand to Chicago, and we also have data for Swaziland, Africa, as well.
Wow! Any other countries outside the United States where you're collecting some data?
Not at this moment, but we plan to. That is why it's called The Rebel Traveler's Guide to the World.
Okay. How did the Mandela Washington Fellowship for Young African Leaders Reciprocal Exchange factor into what you've been doing?
Well, we met them, and they got us in contact with a group in Swaziland. And they helped us design a bit of the app, as well as we met with several different groups. The Council for Disabled Persons, and I can't remember the name of the other group at the moment, but they helped us collect most of the data that we have now for Swaziland.
Okay.
And working with those groups themselves, we were able to get a wide picture of the community there in Swaziland.
Okay. And so tell us, you've done a lot of traveling. You've been to China. You've been to the Great Wall, had some experiences there. Tell us some other places you visited and what some of the challenges were that you faced there.
I've been to China, Thailand, Tibet, India, Egypt, Africa, Israel. I've been all over the world. I have tried my hardest to get, you know, into all the famous landmarks, and most of them, except when I wasn't discriminated against by policy, I've been able to overcome with a little elbow grease.
Okay, well, a little elbow grease. That's, I don't know, my father always told me that that solved a lot of problems. What was the best trip out of all of those that you were like? And then tell us how it could have been improved by an app like the one you're developing.
I guess I would have to say my favorite trip so far actually has been Swaziland. It's a wonderful country. The people there are wonderful. The way my travel could have been improved would be to know that, for example, there aren't any wheelchairs publicly available or any kind of disabled supplies. They actually have to be given by the government. They have to be willed over by the government. The prime minister, I believe, has to have some wheelchairs in stock that he will give out.
Wow. And so you didn't know that before you went there. So how did you manage that then once you got there?
Well, my wheel broke while touring Swaziland. And luckily, one of the groups we were with knew this group in Swaziland who actually were working on building wheels for wheelchairs as replacements. So luckily, they were able to, you know, make me a temporary one. But without their resource, I would have been stranded, really.
Yeah, you'd have been in big trouble.
There were no resources.
So the difficulties that you've experienced while traveling with a wheelchair aren't just limited to the destinations you travel to. You've also had some problems in an airport, correct?
Mm-hmm. O'Hare.
And what happened there?
Well, they treated us basically like cattle. They put us into this, I don't know if you'd call it a room or a long hallway. There were about, I don't know, 20 of us. They put us into this room, left us all waiting there for a good, I don't know, half hour. And we were waiting around, you know, our flight had just landed after a long flight from, I think it was Turkey. And they wouldn't let us leave on our own. They needed qualified airport staff to take us around. And obviously, okay. They didn't tell us this. So were just stranded.
Oh, wow. That's horrible. Very quickly, where can we go to find out more about your app?
Facebook.com at Rebel Traveler.
Okay, Gabriel Sleevy.
First link.
All right, Gabriel Sleevy lives in Eau Claire and is developing an app called The Rebel Traveler's Guide to the World, focusing on making travel more accessible for people with disabilities. He's also developing a mobile site. Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Actress Viola Davis recently wrote a sequel to the much-beloved children's book Corduroy. The book was so important to her as a child and still as an adult because the character was an African-American girl. As the morning show continues, we'll talk about whether diverse representation in children's literature and media impacts their perceptions of gender and race. Later on, we'll also explore how libraries and schools can address this issue. What children's book or children's book character has affected your life? Why? Parents, do you talk to your children about gender and race? Which books do you use to have this conversation? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Louise Amarez is professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content. Louise, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you.
When do children start forming perceptions of gender and race?
Well, it looks like children start noticing kind of race, or at least paying attention to racial features, as early as 3 or 4 months, that they start looking more at the sorts of faces that they've seen in their environment, their caregivers. So it's something that they start noticing really early, and they start kind of forming theories about, particularly if we don't talk to them about it.
So what factors go into helping children form their understandings?
Well, I think parents talking to them about it, using books and television as ways of kind of showing that different types of people matter, that we can sort of watch and admire and enjoy kind of images of different groups, and being willing to kind of label and discuss them. And certainly, you know, there's plenty of research that suggests that African-American and Hispanic and even Asian-American families do that. White families often have somewhat less comfort doing that.
And why is that? Do we know?
Well, I think it often comes from pretty good intentions, as well as some kind of level of discomfort, you know, that is, I mean, it makes perfect sense why, say, African-American families do talk about it, because they want to kind of assure their kids that they matter, you know, and we know that, say, African-American kids and Hispanic or Asian-American kids notice that there are fewer representations, and they care. They want to see characters and content that captures them in some way. Whereas white parents, I think often they're worried that they're going to make their kid racist, actually, if they kind of name or point out the characters are or aren't of different races or ethnicities. And so it might come from a good place, but it's not necessarily a great thing.
What evidence is there that children connect the positive or negative representations of gender and race to their understanding of themselves?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I think one is that minority kids will sort of speak about wanting to see depictions of themselves, or feeling saddened or disheartened when all they see are kind of negative representations. I think on the other hand, and I think gender role stereotypes play roles too, right? That kind of perceptions of what's appropriate for a boy to do or a girl to do can be pretty powerful, particularly when kids go through this kind of phase of really kind of carving out those boundaries of boys versus girls being, and which is like around 3 to 5. It's often pretty potent as a divider. So I think, you know, it matters that there's representations and that there's varied representations so that kids can kind of connect across these kind of multiple dimensions. So, for example, when Dora came out, when Latino kids were watching and researchers were like, how similar do you feel to Dora? You know, the Latino boys were like, well, no. I mean, yes, she's Latino, but I'm a boy and she's a girl and I want someone that's me, you know. So it's a complicated but important kind of area.
Well, and when it comes to gender, I mean, oftentimes, you know, that the imaging there starts practically from birth. Girls get to have a lot of pink in their room, and boys, it's blue. I mean, those are just cultural traditions, at least in Western culture. And it's like these are just cultural norms. They're accepted. How do we deal with some of that?
Well, I think by kind of allowing kids to kind of graze freely, by offering them some alternatives, And by kind of noticing when we make assumptions or sort of steer them towards things. I mean, for example, when I would play with my kids in the aisles at Target, I would notice sometimes that boys, young boys, were like attracted to Barbie. And in a way, who wouldn't be attracted to Barbie? She's like incredibly glitzy, you know, but my parents sometimes seem pretty uncomfortable with the idea that their little boy wanted a glitzy Barbie. And so thinking about why we're uncomfortable about that and kind of, you know, whether it would in fact be fine or just as problematic for a boy to have Barbie as it would be for a girl to have Barbie, I think it's kind of useful to reflect on what we're thinking.
Well, let's be honest. I mean, the assumption there is if boys want to play with Barbie, that must mean they're gay.
Yeah, might well be that kind of fear. And thinking through, like, well, really? Do I really think that if a boy is going to play with Barbie, that's going to somehow make him gay? And second, kind of, why would I sort of be concerned if my kid is gay? It's not like, you know. So I think thinking through and kind of reflecting on that is useful.
There are a lot of landmines out there. We're talking about whether diverse representation in children's literature and media impacts their perceptions of gender and race. Later on this hour, we'll talk about how public libraries and schools are addressing this issue. My guest is Louise Mares, professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content. What children's book or children's book character has affected your life? Why? And parents, how do you talk to your children about gender and race? We'd like to hear from you this morning. What's your story? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So all of these, the representations, negative or positive, of various gender and race imagery, that has to have some sort of impact on the self-esteem of children. Talk a little bit about what is that impact and how does that manifest itself?
Well, I think media are part of a larger kind of set of messages about who matters. And kind of what's possible. And I think it's really important that all parents have kind of content that they can use to assure their kid. You matter, you're important, here's where you come from, here are kind of people, here's your history, and here's what you can be. And to kind of have books and paintings and TV content that they can use to support that. And there's plenty of research that suggests that parents having those kind of conversations with their kid helps their kid feel sort of better about themselves, feel supported, and kind of more resilient when they do in fact face kind of prejudice in society.
Actress Viola Davis loved the book Corduroy because she felt represented by the character who was a black girl. She still remembers that book all these years later, and it was so important to her that she wrote a sequel. Now, this seems like an example of how media and representation can stick with us well beyond childhood. How far-reaching are the lessons we learn from media?
Oh, I think they can be tremendously important. I think that a single character, as you say, can kind of last forever in one's head and kind of be someone that felt like a friend for years, who offered kind of hope about what was possible. And so I think these are can be really strong and powerful connections. And I think then we have to give kids some options, right? It can't just be that one character has to take kind of all the possibilities for all the kids out there, because kind of within a given racial or gender group, there are lots of kids with different experiences. So we need, lots of options for kids to have hope.
Can you give us some examples of children's TV shows or books that are good examples of how diversity can be best addressed with children?
Well, I think, for example, it's great that we have Doc McStuffins, who is, you know, a young African-American character, kind of the lead rather than just kind of a minor sidekick. I think it was great that there was Kailan for a while as Chinese-American. But I think one thing that's interesting about these things is while these shows can be kind of obvious and transparent, say, to minority kids, for white kids or kids who aren't members of that group, sometimes they're not necessarily as clear, and kids need adults to kind of point out connections, like, oh, you know, Dora speaks Spanish like Joey in your class, you know, get it?
Mm-hmm. All right. Louise Maris is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content. We're talking about whether diverse representation in children's literature and media impacts their perceptions of gender and race. Later on in the hour, we'll also explore how public libraries and schools are addressing this issue. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. How does diverse representation in children's literature and media impact children's perception of gender and race? Well, that's what we're talking about this hour on The Morning Show. Later on, we'll explore how public libraries and schools address this issue. What children's book or children's book character has affected your life? Why? Parents, how do you talk to your children about issues of gender and race? Which books or programs do you use to help you with this conversation? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Louise Maris is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content, and she's with us this morning to talk about these issues. Louise, you've studied how children and parents approach discussions of diversity. What have you observed?
Well, I think that often parents are surprised at what their kids are thinking, because often what their kids are thinking are not what the parents sort of think. And so, for example, white kids often don't notice that or understand, for example, that Dora's meant to be Latino. When I would ask them, you know, where may Dora have come from, they'd be like, well, she's speaking French, but she comes from the other Madison. You know, so there'd be these sort of deep confusions about what exactly that was meant to represent. So I think having more conversations would be great, and then having more options, particularly for some groups that remain really underrepresented, like Native Americans on television, virtually no images, particularly for children, of that experience.
Well, when we think about it, it makes perfect sense that children would see the world that way, because their worldview is based on our worldview, and our perceptions are based on what we've experienced so far, and so young children just wouldn't have a lot of experience and a lot of other input to tell them what they should think, unlike adults who've had a lifetime to accumulate the things that go into how we perceive the world. So knowing this, then, how do families approach this conversation differently based on their own racial makeup?
Well, I think it would be, I'm really glad you're speaking to a librarian next, because I think libraries and books have this tremendous role that you can kind of seek out content that shows different, as well as your own group, right? And then kind of use it to kind of discuss, look at, point to pictures, sort of observe what's different and the same about their experiences in the book compared to your own, and kind of be willing to actually give kids language or to ask them what they think, and then get a sense of, like, how confused they are about kind of what that character is supposed to mean. I think it's really useful. I think parents are way more willing to say that's a boy or that's a girl, and much less willing to say that character's black or that character's Native American. And so being willing to do that and then to kind of listen to the kid ask questions and answer them, I think can be really powerful.
So what happens for children in the absence of conversations and experiences with different races?
Well, I think one thing they learn is that this is a really uncomfortable topic, that if adults kind of don't want to mention it, in fact, kind of skip past questions or just kind of seem blithely to prefer not to talk about it, then that this is somehow problematic. And so I think, in a way, expressing comfort, being willing to talk about it, being willing to kind of show that you're comfortable interacting and with people of different races and ethnicities is part of actually achieving what parents want, which is that their kid has that level of comfort and ease in the world.
Well, and modeling behavior is always crucial in childhood development. And I think, you know, parents, they gain an understanding if they don't have it right off the bat, that children observe and see much more than we think they do.
Absolutely. They really do. You know, in fact, there's some research suggesting that kind of what parents say, particularly for preschool age kids, is even somewhat less important than kind of their body language, the kind of warmth with which adults are seen interacting across racial and ethnic lines. And so kind of the best predictor of kids' kind of racial attitudes are kind of whether the mom has friends of different races and ethnicities. So we are sending messages to our kids. And we kind of need to think a little bit about what those messages are, because the absence of kind of explicit modeling or explicit conversations is actually a pretty powerful message.
So the whole thing can just become sort of a taboo.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of sad and dangerous.
We're talking about how diverse representation in children's literature and media impact children's perception of gender and race with Louise Amarez, a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. She studies how children interpret and respond to media content. We'd like you to respond to our media content, joining our conversation here at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. So do race and gender need to be frankly discussed with children, or is it possible for them to form an understanding by the mere presence of diversity? So let's say that mom and dad have a diverse group of friends, and they are around people of different ethnicities and maybe even different gender roles. If we don't talk to them about it specifically, can just our behavior make the complete picture here?
Well, I think our behavior has a huge impact. Yeah, and I think parents having a diverse group of friends, great. I think kids seeing those warm, friendly interactions is probably going to be the most powerful thing there is. But I think in the absence of that, because you know, not everyone has diverse groups of friends, or to complement that, I think using media, but then using media mindfully and being willing to talk about it can be also really useful. But assuming that kids will somehow just be able to know that this character is meant to connect in these ways to the kids I see at school or in preschool, that I think is a mistake. I think, for example, TV depictions are often animated, and those sort of images, those animated images, are clear to us, but not necessarily clear to children.
How does diversity of children's authors and TV show producers or writers have an impact on the content that we see?
Oh, I think that's clearly tremendously important. Sort of questions of authenticity and even just thinking about kind of the particularities. And what I mean by particularities is kind of getting the details right. Like, so when Viola Davis talks about caring about Lisa, the character in Corduroy, I mean, what matters, right, is that this girl is dressed and looks and behaves in this very sort of nice, beautiful, identifiable way. And so getting the details right so that a kid can identify with that person, I think is tremendously important.
What tips do you have for parents for having the kinds of frank conversations we're suggesting with their children?
Well, I think thinking about kind of sitting down, making it part of your evening routine or whatever, right? Having an array of books that you help your kid pick out from the library or whatever, or sitting and watching the TV shows and saying, just occasionally asking questions like, well, where do you think, you know, say Doc lives, where, you know, who is she like in your class? Mm-hmm. You know, do you notice that Doc's African-American like your friend Sarah is, you know, and being willing to use the language, I think, and being comfortable about it, okay. I think is really helpful.
We have a caller who wants to join us. Let's hear from Liz, who's calling us from southeastern Wisconsin. Liz, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to the program, and the reverse of what's being discussed is happening at my child's school. She goes to a very small school in a very small community, and I purposefully take her out there. But every race is represented at this school, where there is a total from kindergarten to eighth grade, 50 students. All of the kids play together of all the age groups, and I had commented to my best friend last year, how will we explain to the kids when they get out of this school that this scenario is not how it's going to be in all places in the great big world? And our English teacher this year signed for the seventh and eighth graders a book called Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. And so that kind of got some of the kids thinking, well, why is this happening there? And that has led to the discussion of your different colors might not always be.
Okay. Liz, we're running out of time, and I'd like to give our guest a chance to respond. Louise?
I think it's great your kid is going to such a diverse school. I think I love that you're bringing up that a book can offer kind of a chance to have insight and empathy about prejudice and kind of have kind of this vicarious experience of what that feels like, and to recognize that it's not all friendship, that there are really negative experiences out there and what that might be like.
Louise Mares, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Louise Mares is a professor of communication arts at UW-Madison. Coming up next on The Morning Show, we explore how one library system in Wisconsin is working to address representation and diversity in the literature available to children in their community. We welcome your participation in the program. Get a hold of us at 800-642-1234. What's happening in your community? It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about how issues of representation and diversity in literature are available to children in their communities. Librarians and teachers, how do you teach your students about experiences and people different from them? Let us know, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Beth McIntyre is a librarian at Madison Public Library. She works to develop and update the library's collection. Beth, thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me, John.
So how do libraries play a role in children's development?
There's kind of three basic ways libraries, kind of public libraries I'm talking about right now, play a role in children's development. One is access to materials. We try to build these kind of large, diverse collections that especially kids who are in the pre-reading stage and children who are learning to read can just have a ton of options. I think parents who have a child who just started to learn to read all know how exciting that is and how you just want to tear through anything you can get your hands on. And libraries really kind of provide kind of access to anything a kid might want to read without kind of that financial obligation on the part of the parents. They can just get as many kids books as their kids, you know, want in their hands during that really exciting time. Another way that libraries kind of support child development is through intentional programming for kids of all ages, but, you know, especially focusing on kind of early literacy and, you know, child development at that stage, and then through kind of strategic partnerships with other organizations in the community that are kind of doing the same type of work.
So let's talk about the Madison Public Library specifically. What kind of programming and children's literacy initiatives do you have?
Well, you know, I can speak from my end as a collection development librarian, which is kind of building collections and creating access. You know, we are very, very intentional about what we buy, what we display, what we put face out, so that any child walking into our library, I mean, we can't make the promise that any child can find something that kind of reflects their experience, because, you know, we're kind of at the mercy of what's published. But we, you know, we go out of our way to be very, very intentional about what we purchase. There's kind of an old saying in children's literature that children need mirrors and windows, and that's always kind of what we're trying to provide, a window into someone else's life and a mirror to reflect your own experience.
And do you know, do public schools attempt to follow similar standards in their libraries?
They do. They definitely do. You know, I can't speak, you know, super detailed about, you know, MMSD or any school district's kind of policies or initiatives, but school librarians are really in there putting in the work of supporting the curriculum in their school, supporting the teachers in their school to try to find, you know, reflective literature for all children. And then also they have that kind of like captive audience of one-on-one with all of those kids, and those partnerships that the public library and the school library kind of do to do wraparound services all year are a really, really important part of both of our jobs.
We're talking with Beth McIntyre, librarian at the Madison Public Library, talking about how issues of representation and diversity in literature are available to children in our communities. Beth, how do you ensure that you are serving a diverse audience?
You know, when we are kind of putting together programming and, you know, it's, and, you know, getting materials in the library, I know that I have to, if I kind of follow the, you know, kind of traditional way of collection development, which is kind of the mainstream professional, you know, kind of journals and publications that, you know, speak to these things, sometimes, you know, you can still end up with a bit of a homogenous collection. And so, you know, it's part of a librarian's job to be very intentional of kind of going outside that stream, of finding voices from your own community and different communities across the country that are lifting up diverse voices to make sure you're getting those books in your collection, or that you're, you know, getting the types of programming people are looking for.
I want to go back, loop back, and follow up on something you said earlier about, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of what's available. Mm-hmm. Is there a lack of diversity in children's book authors or the publishing industry that might perpetuate the lack of diversity we might see in characters in children's literature?
Absolutely. The Cooperative Children's Book Center, that I think I might have gotten that mixed up, the CCBC here at the UW does a lot of great work every year with kind of keeping statistics of diversity in publishing. And the truth of the matter is it hasn't really gotten that much better since the 1960s. You know, things are kind of slowly growing, and in the children's lit world, there are a lot of organizations and kind of initiatives that have sprung up over the past few years to draw attention to diversity in children's literature, to try to kind of promote, you know, you know, kind of more publishing and more we call own voices, which is, you know, someone from a marginalized or, you know, minority community writing their own stories and having their own stories published. But it does take intentionality to try to get those books. You might not always find them in the same mainstream channels. So, you know, it's something that librarians have to work at, but it's part of our job.
What is the Library Bill of Rights?
The Library Bill of Rights is kind of a collection of guiding principles developed by the American Library Association that kind of govern services to libraries, all kinds of libraries in the United States. So it kind of talks about, it's just kind of a set of ground rules. For an example, you know, materials are going to be provided for the interest, information, and enlightenment of all people in the community that the library serves. It addresses things like censorship, that, you know, libraries should be on the front lines of challenging censorship and provide materials that, promote different points of view and opposing points of view. That's something that libraries have always taken really seriously, and it's right there kind of in our Bill of Rights.
You know, I was thinking as we were talking about this a little, how my mother took me by the hand and mm-hmm. walked me down to what was then the Carnegie Free Library in the tiny town of Hayward, Wisconsin, and introduced me to the world of books. And I think it's appropriate as we come to the end of this hour that we talk about how parents play a role in the diversity of experiences and teachings their kids encounter. Talk about that a little bit. What is the parental role here? And what advice do you have for parents?
Absolutely. And John, I just want to let you know that little story you told is the type of, like, tell that story anytime you're talking to a librarian. We love that sort of thing. when you're thinking about books, that even when you're taking a trip to the library with your kid and you're picking up books together, put some books in your bag that aren't about a child that looks like your child, especially if your child is kind of part of the dominant, like, white middle class culture that exists in children's books. You don't have to always make a huge deal about it. You're there to hear stories, and you're there to hear all sorts of stories, so make some room in your library bag for just different types of things. See what sticks, see what's interesting. And always leave, room in the library bag for choice of the child, because you'll, always be interested. You'll always be surprised by what they kind of pick up and are interested in themselves.
And if you don't know exactly what it is you're looking for,
ask a librarian.
You can always ask a librarian. There you go.
That's what we're there for.
Well, we kind of don't think about that all the time, though. When we go in, and it's okay, here's the library, kids. Take a look at what you'd like to read, and just have at it. I'm going to go look at this magazine.
Absolutely, and we field a lot of questions that we. We're a resource, and we're here for the community. We field a lot of questions from grandparents around the holidays. I want to buy my child a gift. What's good? We're there for you, and if we don't know the answer, we will find it.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for sharing this time with us this morning. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Beth McIntyre is a librarian at Madison's Public Library. She works to develop and update the library's collection. Thank you to all who contributed during the fall membership drive. You donated more than $600,000. More than 3,300 listeners pledged, including more than 700 new members. Your gift ensures Wisconsin has a vital, strong public radio service. Thank you so much.